Hello, and welcome to your Community Radio News Desk. I'm Adrienne Murphy. Coming up today, Dundalk FM's Marissa Lucchesi spoke to Dundalk Fianna Fáil councillor Emma Coffey on her Brexit prediction that there would be a hard border. Johnny Holmes talks to Miriam Tabor from Drink Aware in relation to off-the-shelf personal breathalysers. But first, in the event of a hard Brexit, we may see armed forces returning to the border. But how are the paying conditions for our defence forces, and can we retain and recruit the necessary numbers? Earlier, I spoke to PD Fora General Secretary Ger Guinan, and I began by asking him how many defence force families are currently in receipt of supplementary welfare payments in order to make ends meet.
I can't give you an exact figure on that, unfortunately. However, I will say that there are some, and it's some too many. We do have members on family income supplement, or the working family payment, as it's now called, and there are undoubtedly significant numbers of members of the Defence Forces that are experiencing difficulty, financial difficulty at the moment. I will say that the issues in relation to the Defence Forces at the moment, they're not just solely about pay. There are issues in relation to allowances. You have to distinguish between the pay of members and the allowances that they receive for working additional hours. You also have to look at their contracts of employment and the application of the Working Time Directive. All of these factors are leading to the current difficulties in crisis, actually, in recruitment and retention within the Defence Forces.
Yes, and there was actually a report done, was it 2016, the workplace climate in the Defence Force. That was published last year, I believe.
The climate survey report was published in, there was two, there was a qualitative and a quantitative assessment done, and the reports related back to a survey that was done by the University of Limerick. And just as a, I mean, as a statistic that was there, there was 91% of the personnel surveyed thought that, you know, appropriate pay for additional hours was important. However, of that survey, of that 91%, 55% actually did not believe that they were properly remunerated for the job that they actually done or the additional hours that they actually worked. And that is a considerable factor in terms of the loss of good and qualified personnel from the Defence Forces currently.
And there's a lot of training that they have to do. How much training do they do before they can actually, you know, before they're qualified?
Most members would have to do sort of 12 weeks basic training, and then they'd have to do another 13 to 17 weeks of two to three star training. So you're talking maybe 27 weeks, roughly about 27 weeks of training before they would become a three star. But that's, I mean, if you look at the numbers that are actually coming in and out of the Defence Forces at the moment, you're talking about possibly about 700 to 800 personnel in training, just doing the basic training. Not now, you're talking, that's just the basic to get you up to a three-star private level. So if you take it that it's taken roughly approximately 6 months to train those people, you've got about 400 people who are completely unavailable for a full year. So you divide the full amount of people that are in training, take them on training at 6 months, and then if you were to double that, like you'd end up with about 400 people that are unavailable at all for frontline duties. Couple that then with people who have to do your training in terms of your NCOs course, standard NCOs course to become sergeants, people who would be undergoing training for bomb disposal, etc., etc. I mean, the Defence Forces are an organisation that is highly involved in training, you know, training for overseas, preparation for overseas, training for membership of specialist units, like the Army Ranger Wing. All of these units, they require specialist training, and that's what we do. It's part and parcel of the job.
Yes. I mean, a majority of our Defence Forces are on peacekeeping missions.
Well, I wouldn't say majority, but I'd say about 20% every year.
Then what would you say then to people who might say, well, if we're a neutral country, do we need a Defence Force?
Well, you see, I think it's a basic misconception of actually what the Defence Forces do.
Yes.
I mean, if you look at, say, the Air Corps, they do air ambulance, they do maritime patrols, they've done the firefighting last year, you know, when the fires were on, they've done drops. If you look at the Navy, they do fishery protection, drug interdiction. They were involved down in the Mediterranean on Operation Pontus. You know, they do sort of search and rescue for trawlers and stuff like that. And if you look at the Army, then lots of aid to the civil authority allowance, cordon and search. You had people, if they go missing, that the Army is called in to do cordon and search. They've done firefighting. They would have assisted the civil powers with the storms Emma and Sophia and the guard prisons, and they go overseas. So, like, travel overseas is a very small part of actually what we do. And then you've got a huge cohort of personnel who are the logistical backup to the frontline services. So you've got your mechanics who would fix the vehicles. You've got your chefs who would cook for people. You know, all of these people contribute to the operational effectiveness of the Defence Forces. Most of the public just look at the guys, you know, they see the guys overseas, or they see the guys during Storm Emma or whatever, but they don't think about actually what they do with the back of that. I mean, all of that, there is preparation that is ongoing every single day in order to keep up your skills. We are a fighting force at the end of the day. We are the people who underpin the democracy of the state. And like I said, that involves serious training.
Yes, yes, definitely. What about the pay scale then? So where would they come in at? You know, because we have the nurses going on strike and they're on really, really bad money, and it takes them so long to rise. I think 21 years, they said, to rise to 40,000. So what sort of a pay scale do they come in on?
I honestly couldn't tell you about the nurse's pay scale, but I will
I'm talking about you.
Oh, entry. Yeah, no, but just I don't know what is the upper level for a nurse, but I will say, like, that the members of the Defence Forces, the starting pay of a three-star private is approximately 27,500 euros before tax. That's inclusive of MSA. And then it rises to 38,000 euros before tax after 9 years. So it takes 9 years.
Yes.
But on a comparative basis, I mean, but I think really the one of the main things is that there's no correlation between the pay and the hours that people work. So you would have actually found that members of the Defence Forces are, like I said, severely, you know, disenfranchised by virtue of the fact that the Organisation of Working Time Act or the Working Time Directive doesn't apply. And you could have members that would be working, you know, upwards of 60 to 100 hours a week. And that is fantastical, I know it sounds like, but it is actually a fact. I mean, the military done a survey of the working time within the Defence Forces in the past couple of years, and they found that people were working those hours. So if you're looking at a basic pay of 27,500 euros before tax and you're working 60 hours, it's not making sense to you.
No. It turns out it's about fiver an hour then.
Like I said, if you're working 100 hours, it can work out with that.
Yes, yeah. So what then are you doing? Because I read there that there was a ship actually that didn't go out because there weren't enough staff. So you're unable to, is it you're unable to retain staff, people are going, or you're not able to get new recruits because the salaries are so low or the conditions are so bad?
It's a combination of both. I think PD4 is primarily concerned with the retention of personnel at the moment. Mm-hmm. That's our main objective, is to increase the allowances and make it attract. Well, I was saying to you, Adrian, PD4 is really concentrated on retaining the people that we actually have in service at the moment. We made a comprehensive submission to the Public Service Pay Commission last year. It was 120 pages long, and we outlined where we believed increases needed to be made in order to retain people in service. And these were primarily concerned with the security duty allowance rates and issues in relation to the 10% that was reduced on the main duty allowances as part of the Haddington Road Agreement in 2013, 2014. So that's where we're primarily focused on. But we also have claims for increased military service allowance to take into account the increased sort of urbanization of the defense forces and the pressures that people are under in terms of trying to rent and purchase properties.
That was Ger Guinan, General Secretary of PD4, the Permanent Defence Force Other Ranks Representative Association there. Now, Fianna Fáil Councillor Emma Coffey attracted national media attention 18 months ago when she stated publicly that, in her opinion, a hard border was inevitable and as such we should be preparing for it. Dundalk FM's Marissa Lucchesi spoke to Councillor Emma Coffey and began by asking her if anyone had actually admitted they should have listened to her 18 months ago.
I won't say that they've turned around and said they've listened, but they haven't. They certainly haven't. They haven't disagreed with me when I've raised it, that I spoke about it 18 months ago. Now, I called in those circumstances. I said, I said what I said. I'm not retracting it, but I said it in circumstances where the language being used by both Michel Barnier at the time and the UK government, I could see no alternative but a hard border. And to me, a hard border is a manned border. A manned border is a hard border to me, because we don't have that here at present. And that's one of the benefits of obviously being an EU member state. Michel Barnier in the Dáil, when he came and visit, he said that there would be a consequence to a friction. You know, if there was no agreement or the withdrawal agreement, there would not be a frictionless border. Now, you can say whatever you can say, but to me, that's a border. That's a hard border. And I called in those circumstances that, look, we're looking at a hard border, so let's prepare for a hard border. Now, I haven't seen anything since that would indicate that we are preparing for a hard border. Now, maybe there's lots of plans going on indoors or outdoors in regards to governments and etc. But just before the Christmas break up of the Dáil, there was a 130-page report of the planned exit for a no deal, for our basically our blueprint. And I read it, and there's nothing in it to indicate to me that actually hard concrete plans are in place. It's indicated that there's 21 pieces of legislation that needs to be enacted by the Irish Leinster House, basically by the government or by the bodies, to ensure that there's regulations to foresee for a no deal Brexit. The government has indicated that, well, we still have to wait and see what Westminster are going to do. So they're actually not going to get that piece, but those pieces of legislation before committee and pass in the Dáil until the 1st of March. That's the deadline. So effectively, if we are facing a no deal Brexit, we are going to have chaos and a flurry of activity in March, where all the other day-to-day issues are going to be set aside so that these 21 pieces of legislation can be enacted. Now, obviously, me being a lawyer, I have a particular interest in this, because you could basically put a hodgepodge of a number of acts together to pass it on the one piece of legislation, but that causes its problems. You know, legislation is acted. Even when legislation is debated at committee stage, gone to the Dáil, amendments are made, gone back to committee stage, gone to the Seanad. I mean, there's structures in there in place. I can't see a proper analysis of that legislation within a 30-day or a 29-day framework, you know, to go through the organs. And, you know, that's when errors occur. And when we're facing a no-deal Brexit, we need to have all the organs basically up and running to deal with this. Now, I appreciate no one knows what's going to happen, but we certainly don't want to be in a situation where the country comes to a halt in this part of the country, i.e. the border counties. You know, we have a border corridor on either side, the north and the south, you know, counties either side, where, you know, are, I don't know how many times our pints of milk go over and back the border between coming from, you know, pasteurisation to the shelves. But I mean, that's just one instance of it. I think I spoke about, you know, we have a, there's an issue in relation to our foster care system, because we have a an agreement on mm-hmm. either side of the border between, I know locally between Dundalk and Newry have a liaison and an agreement with there. And that's a whole issue that, you know, wasn't even brought on it. We have the whole aspect of, you know, people going to get their prescriptions. You know, if you have a prescription here in the south, you can get your prescription in the north. Is there going to be a run on that post March?
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, you're going to have a 2-year lead-in period. But if we're going to have a shortage of medicines, are people going to go up north and get their medicines? You know, these are all the issues. The government are issuing, please don't stockpile, please don't stockpile. But at the end of the day, the reality is on the ground, and people, you know, pharmacies, businesses, if they're in short supply of certain, particularly in the medical aspects of it, if they're in short supply of particular medicines or particular apparatus, they're going to, you know, that there's a quality there. Of course, they're going to stockpile these issues. So, I mean, it doesn't. The language and the messages from our government, and I appreciate they're saying to give the UK time and to deal with it, but it certainly doesn't strike me with confidence in regards to the plan for a no deal. We're still no clearer as to what the plan is if there's a no deal. They're talking about buying, you know, lands down in Rosslare for, you know, a so-called customs aspect of it. There hasn't even been a plan and application or a preliminary plan and application brought forward for the Rosslare customs buildings and customs systems to be put in place in that. So, I mean, that all needs to be done, and that won't happen overnight. But it just doesn't. It's kind of saying, well, we won't do anything. Well, let's hope that there's going to be a last gasp attempt. Well, I like to be the maker of my own destiny. I don't know. And I think most people are looking to the government to basically, you know, that's what they're elected to do.
Mm.
And 18 months later, unfortunately, my statement has rung true, and I want to be very clear about it. I did not want this situation to happen. I am not somebody who wants to see a border again in my country. I remember as a very small child going through the border and going through a manned border. And it is not something that I want my daughter to see again on this island. And we only have to see what happened in Derry at the weekend. Mm. And I don't mind, and I'm sure I'm not the only one, that when I saw the video footage of a group of young people walking past that car half an hour before, the hair on the back of my neck stood up again. And I went, I don't want this to happen in my country again. This is not what we need. I do believe we need a cohesive approach, both north and south. I think we're very much hampered by the fact that we have no governmental representation in the north, no Stormont. And I mean, if you think we're bad down here in our preparedness, the north are rudderless, you know. And if it's not for the civil servants doing the pay, they have all the papers and the sort of roadmaps, but they've no one to steer the show or steer the ship up there, because there's no government bodies in place. And it's a terrible plight to be the citizens in the six counties and to not have that. You know, so at least we have a government here. There is, you know, there is that. I mean, it's not, I still wouldn't be happy in the manner in which it's been gone about it. And I mean, in fairness, finally, my own party and the parliamentary party are saying, where is the plan? We haven't got the plan. The plan is short. I mean, people on the street are talking to me going, well, where is the plan? This, people on the street knew that this, you know, when I made that statement 18 months ago, people turned around to me and said, well, you're the only one who was saying it as it is. And they're turning around to me and saying, well, what is going to happen?
That was Councillor Emma Coffey there, and our thanks to Dundalk FM for that piece. Finally, as the prospect of Garda drink driving checkpoints in the mornings draws attention from all sections of society, including government TDs, the issue of off-the-shelf breathalysers has arisen. These range in price from £3.50 to several hundred euros. Johnny Holmes spoke to Miriam Tabor from Drink Aware, and he first asked her opinion on the validity of these off-the-shelf personal breathalysers.
Yeah, so we would say that this is
you know, it's a relatively new space. And these off-the-shelf breathalyzers, most of which are usually available to buy online, so they're not developed with the same medical or safety technology or standards as those used by our officials, like the guards. So what we're trying to say to people is that because this is quite an unregulated space, and these breathalyzers, which can range, you know, you could be paying, I've heard of one person paying 70 euro for one online, but then I've heard of lots of other people spending 5 euro to get one. So if you think about it logically, if you're paying just a fiver for an off-the-shelf breathalyzer, and usually they're single use that you can buy online, is that it's not going to be to the same standards as the ones used by the guards. And I guess, you know, we would advocate the same way as the Road Safety Authority would, is that we really would have concerns about the accuracy of these results. And, you know, I know a lot of people are using these breathalyzers for information purposes and for their own kind of peace of mind. And, you know, that's fantastic, and people should. And it's great to see people being more proactive about taking the morning after seriously when it comes to driving. However, we would just remind people that there's no guarantee that you won't or that you will pass the official test if you pass a guard a checkpoint, because as we say, the standards are of a much higher quality with their tests than they would be for the ones that you buy online.
Okay. And what are the views of Road Safety Authority on this?
So the Road Safety Authority would very much echo our own views, which is that, you know, we would have concerns about the validity of these results and the accuracy, and also people's this kind of rise that we're seeing in a reliance on these off-the-shelf breathalyzers. So we would just say, you know, have it for information purposes. You know, it's fantastic that people are taking this seriously. And we know that there are more Gardaí morning after checkpoints than normal. But we would just say, don't take it as a guarantee if you pass that test that you will be under the limit at an official checkpoint.
Right. And for driving the morning after, or even in the afternoon after a night's drinking party, tell us about the length of time it takes for alcohol to leave the human body system.
Yeah, so it takes on average 1 hour for the body to process one standard drink. So examples of a standard drink that people might know are a half pint of beer or stout or lager, a small glass of wine, which is smaller than people think, it's 100 mils, or a pub measure of spirits, so that's your standard 35.5 mil pour. So I suppose what we're trying to say to people is, first of all, you'd have to get your head around the standard drink. So one pint is actually two standard drinks. So we're talking 2 hours to process a pint there. And, you know, there's lots of things that will affect that. You know, gender is one thing. If you've had food, how quickly you consume the alcohol, if you're mixing drinks, if you're used to drinking, or if this is a once-off, all of these things add together to make it really, really difficult to be able to say for sure the next day and that you're okay to drive. And that's why we would say that it's not just the morning after, as you just said there quite rightly, it could even be into the afternoon, depending on what time you finish drinking, and again, all of those other factors. And, you know, we would also remind people that, because we hear this all the time, is, but sure, if I have a cup of coffee or if I have a cold shower or I go for a run, you know, that's going to sober me up and the alcohol will be processed quicker. But these are just myths. They're not true. Really, it is that any amount of alcohol will affect your ability to drive, and there is just no way around this, and there's no way to process alcohol any quicker. You just need to give it time.
Yes. And wouldn't it be true to say also that each individual's size and metabolism are different? You know, for example, a large man who's used to drinking a few pints on a regular basis may have a better chance to lose alcohol levels quicker than, say, a small person who's not used to drinking.
Yeah, I mean, you know, as we say, there are so many different factors, gender being one, weight being another, as you just said there. They all have a role to play, but we would just encourage people to use the general thumb, which is 1 hour to process one standard drink.
And what about binge drinking? I'm saying this now because some people don't realise what binge drinking is. From my point of view, like a guy who comes home from his week's work on a Friday night, he has a few drinks. Then the football is on Saturday afternoon. He'll have a few more. He goes out that night on Saturday. Then on Sunday, a little bit more football. And then he decides to think, I've worked tomorrow. So I won't drink tonight. Maybe I'll stop at around 7. So wouldn't they be more prone, let's say, to retain alcohol for a longer period in their system after they've stopped drinking? I went through that whole shiramaro about the weekend, because that is actually binge drinking and people don't realise it.
It is. And, you know, it's a great point about people not realising what binge drinking is. And, you know, we know from our own research and from international evidence that Ireland is a bit of a binge drinking nature. We just have that culture here. So it's very normalised in Irish society, where it wouldn't be in lots of other countries. So I suppose just for the official kind of guidance there on binge drinking, it's a lot less than people think it is. It's actually the equivalent of about 3 pints. So it's 6 standard drinks consumed in one sitting, 6 or more standard drinks in one sitting. So I guess what you're saying there is that if somebody has a few pints at one time, takes a break and then goes back and has a few more when they come home, yes, I mean, it's going to take quite a long time for the alcohol to be processed. But also on top of that, there's the increased risk that come with drinking to excess, or, you know, regular binge drinking, that, you know, it just adds to the risks already associated with drinking alcohol on a regular basis. And that could be to your physical health, your mental health, you know, your weight. You're consuming a lot of sugar and calories in alcohol, depending on which type. So, yeah, binge drinking is something that it is normalised in Irish society, but it is something that I think people are becoming more mindful of. You know, we've seen the rise of non-alcoholic drinks in the past few months. You know, there's more availability now. I think the quality has improved, and I think consumers are responding to that. So that's something that we would like to see a bit more of, is if people, especially drinking at home, you know, there's a lot of drinking at home in this country. You know, 72% actually of drinking occasions in Ireland take place in the home, and that's where you're at increased risk of binge drinking, of drinking a lot more than you actually intended, just because it's a comfortable environment, you're at home, you don't have to leave the house, but it's also an uncontrolled environment. So there is that greater likelihood that you will binge drink, or drink, you know, in some cases, even your entire weekly guideline in one night, just sitting on the couch without even intending to. So, you know, it's a great point about binge drinking, and, you know, it would be fantastic if people could visit our website, drinkaware.ie, just to get that information on standard drinks, the low-risk guidelines, just so that they can protect and improve their health and well-being.
Right. Not saying I agree with this now personally, but many out there are saying that it's unfair of the Gardaí to man checkpoint the morning after. Their view is that they deliberately left the car at home, paid for taxis, had a shower and coffee the next morning, and just for a short trip to, let's say, the local supermarket, they drive slow and carefully. To be then caught over the legal limit at checkpoints, and one example of this was in Blanchardstown this year on New Year's Day. What's your view on this?
I mean, from DrinkAware's point of view, you know, we would absolutely support the enforcement of drink driving laws. In fact, the drink driving penalties were just updated at the end of October last year, and that is something that we very much supported. We supported Minister Ross and the Road Safety Authority in actually getting that over the line. And, you know, I think what we're seeing, especially this week, is a lot of people, be it in an official capacity or anecdotally, berating the Gardaí for doing their job, for enforcing the law. That is what the guards are there to do. And I think if you're willing to take the risk, be it the night of or the morning after drinking, knowing how long it takes alcohol to be processed through your body, you're actually making our roads a little bit more dangerous, not just for yourselves, but for all other road users. You know, over 1,000 people were arrested during the Christmas season, just over a couple of weeks in December and into the new year, for drink driving, many of whom ended up being given the penalty for that. And I think, you know, the minimum penalty now is 3 months driving ban. So that is not something to be taken lightly. And that's why we would really say to people that the guards are doing their job by enforcing the law, and, you know, we should follow the law, and it's something that Drink Aware would actively support.
That was Miriam Tabor from Drink Aware. And if you would like more information on this, you can contact Drink Aware on info@drinkaware.ie or call 01 443 1151.